Hi everyone, this is Gilad.
This is Nathan.
And we are here at Bike Banter, here with you once a week, every Thursday. Please join us for some fun bike talk. Feeling it?
Yes.
Well, we're recording right now.
All right.
That's it.
Glad to be here.
Just like that, you're here.
Just like that, yeah. It's nice to see the town kind of come alive, people out and about walking, and saw 9/11 on the way here. For us.
Wait, let me tell, let me make an introduction. I have with me, this is Gilad, and with me is Eric, a different Eric than last time. Eric, which Eric are you?
Last name's Kendall.
How do I know you, Eric?
I walked into a bike shop a long time ago in Eugene, Oregon, and some guy tried to convince me that I needed a single speed because gears were stupid.
Gears are stupid. What'd you do with them?
I disagreed, and I took my 26-inch wheeled Trek and went and rode in the mud, and I was like, well, maybe these gears are, you know, a little stupid. And I got a single speed 29er, and I swore that I didn't need gears at all after that because I could ride 90% of everything without gears. But then my back started to hurt, so I went back to gears.
So that guy that you met, was he a good-looking guy, kind of like me?
Not really, but over time, he's maybe gotten a little better looking, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. This is
and taller.
Okay, this is a big deal. Tall, definitely not. I think with age, we get shorter. You might have shrunk also, so the proportion of shrinking for you are larger than mine, and then maybe I'm taller because of that. Could have been?
Could be.
I mean, we know each other now for 17 years? Wait, 2005, right?
No, I came to Eugene in 2007.
Oh, really? So I was already in Eugene for a year at least. No. Are you sure 2007?
Yeah.
Because I opened the shop already in 2007.
Yeah, 2007. You were working at Paul's.
Correct.
Yeah.
And then I opened the shop. So you met me right before I opened my shop?
You said, hey, I'm going to be opening a bike shop soon. I'm like, sure you are.
Oh, really?
And yeah, so it was like a couple months later. I think I went back to Paul's and...
looking for the short guy?
Yeah. And they're like, well, he's got his own bike shop.
Whoa.
And we're like, no way that thing's going to not last a year. It was because, you know, the Great Recession happened.
Yes, I remember.
And we're like, no way, this isn't going to work. And yeah, Guitar Hero was in the shop.
Oh, yeah.
That needs to come back. You need that in your shop now.
Where do I put it in the shop?
Find a place.
Where?
Anywhere. It'll be
like,
worth
like
it.
Just like
tape. Out on the patio.
Out on the patio, Guitar Hero.
Yeah.
Actually, I bet you that's gonna be good.
That would bring some people.
That will bring some people in.
Yeah. That, you're right. That advice is free.
Okay, I'll take that. Yeah. That's a good advice. So I'll start with like the basic question I like to ask people here. I think, have you ever listened to this podcast?
Yes. The first time on the way down, the drive down here.
Oh, really?
In fact.
Wait, this time?
Yeah, I listened to the last one with Eric. You were talking about trading a kidney to learn how to manual.
I was.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, if anyone here can teach me how to manual, I'm not talking about like giving me the advice of how to do it. I mean, taking me from not manualing to actually manualing, and you need a kidney, you know how to get to me.
Yeah, but we talked about this. Like when I couldn't manual before COVID. COVID hit, and I went to the LCC parking lot every day, and I told myself I was going to work on manuals for a half hour. It was the perfect slope, so you need like the perfect gentle grade, and I just did it over and over and over. A few YouTube videos to cue me in, but essentially it's like sitting back in a chair, like in a recliner.
I know, the L shape, push back, lean back. I can get a manual for about 10 feet, sometimes more if I go faster.
I think it's a consistency thing, like everything in life,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, keep on trying. Keep on doing it. So, Eric, here's an interesting thing about Eric, and then I'll ask him the question I love to ask people. He actually was a customer of mine for a very, very, very long time, and I know him for a very long time. We actually weren't like this great friends before, and in reality is we actually became really good friends, I feel like, right before I left Eugene, which kind of sucked because... Like I feel like 2 years before I left Eugene, we became better friends than we ever had.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Part of that was the 996.
True. Yeah, we have a love for Porsches, like a big love for Porsches. I mean, all Porsches, but specifically for one that nobody likes except for, well, actually more and more people like him now. It's which is kind of nice. We're not alone in the world now of loving our 996, which is, it's a sub brand of 911. So 911s have been made since 63. And basically they're all called 911, but obviously not all 911 are the same. There's new one and older ones and everything in between. And there's certain years, our years, where they're less loved, I would say, but they're becoming more loved now.
But like everybody says, it still drives like a 911.
It still drives like a 911.
And I would say, I mean, I think I would encourage anybody to explore a 996. So like Gilad said, they're made from 98 to 2005. You can read about their engine issues and other quirks, but a lot of it can be mitigated with good servicing and some preventative maintenance.
I think the cool thing about our model of 911 is they're more affordable. So even though now they're actually a lot more expensive than they were when we bought ours, they're still the most affordable ones because everything else went up too. And all the issues that anyone can hear about are all issues that everyone knows already. And that means that there's very easy way to fix them. They're not actually expensive issues. Like all the big issues in our car are pretty cheap to fix and you can do it in advance. Anyway, not a Porsche podcast. We can do that on a different time. But I guess what I wanted to say about you, Eric, is that he's one of the reason why I progressed in riding. I'm a very, if you look at me ride, I'm pretty boring the way I ride, or used to be very boring the way I ride. It's because I came from downhilling. And downhilling is, to be fast, you actually have to be smooth, and smooth is boring. Smooth doesn't look good. And I didn't really progress a lot in the way of like learning how to move on the bike in a way that's also entertaining. For me also, I never like learned how to really enjoy like the just shredding, I guess, right? And Eric, I remember, I think he was like 38 or 40. And he's like, I'm going to learn how to jump, like dirt jumping. And I was like, what are you talking about, old man? You ain't learning how to do anything. And then Eric started by himself going, and you started going to Black Rock, I remember. And then you felt like you weren't doing really well there. And then he started going to Lumberyard in Portland, which is this indoor wooden ramps. And I remember going riding with him after maybe 6 months after he told me starting jumping, which was like this crazy thing. And you were doing no-handers.
Yeah. It's great because it was flat pedals. And I used to freestyle flatland. And so I remember bunny hopping quite high with flat pedals. Then I went to mountain biking and, you know, went to clips. But I guess I had that, you know, that fundamental learning of how to jump without mm-hmm. being clipped in. And that helped a lot. And it all came back when I went to the lumberyard. And yeah, and then you just get a little progress, and then you start going bigger and bigger and bigger. And next thing you know, you're hitting 30-foot gaps and with an open-face helmet, and maybe that's stupid, but,
no, but
it
you're
feels
comfortable.
Totally normal.
Yeah, it feels comfortable. It's. But anyway, like actually, Eric really taught me a lot about that you can progress regardless of not just age, but the kind of like where you – I don't like to use age – as a matrix of doing or not doing stuff. It's more like, I think the older we get, and it could be you're 20 and then you go in 30. It doesn't really matter. It's the older you get, the more comfortable you are with where you are, and you become better at something. And so you feel like you want to hone that, where in reality, you should keep on working on the things you're not good at. And Eric, he really did show me that, you know, doing that, it doesn't matter when, even if you're starting from scratch. And the hardest thing actually doing it for me was like I was really good at something and then suddenly be on the bike on kind of a similar bike than what I know and then be really bad at something was really hard. I think that was the hardest thing for me to do, is like starting something and be sucky at it. Does that make sense at all? I think that's the hardest thing for people to go through.
Yeah, because those first couple times learning are not that fun.
No.
And it's humbling, and we all want to do what we're good at. We go to the gym and do the same exercises because you're like, I'm strong in this, but you avoid doing the stuff you really need to do because it's hard.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember going to, I mean, you told me, go to Lumberyard, and I went to Lumberyard with my family, which was really cool. And by the way, it's really sad it's closed. I don't know if you know, it just closed a couple months ago.
Oh, that is sad. It was like a converted bowling alley and like a great use of a bowling alley.
It was awesome, but I think Corona killed it. I mean, the reality is it was indoor. So, like, as cool as it was, it was indoor, which means there were limited the amount of people that can go in there, which means it kind of closed. But I remember going there, and I went to the green jumps, like the small ones.
Yeah.
And I could not figure out how to do it. Like, I couldn't do it. And there was all these little kids on, like, not push bike, but basically push bike. And they were all perfectly going through the rhythm of it. And I could not understand how to do it.
Right.
So I want to give like a description of what the small jumps were. They were maybe 3 feet high, smaller, 2 feet high, and maybe 2 feet across. I mean, tiny jumps, but they actually have to have a rhythm. Like you couldn't just go fast. You had to have the rhythm of pumping through them in order to actually do it correctly. And that was what teaching you how to do it right. And I remember first time being there, I was there for 2 hours. I was having blisters, again, over the small jumps, nothing big. And it was so frustrating until this one guy came to me and said, like, oh, well, he was doing it, no problem. Adult. He was the first adult that walked into that line. Everyone else was kids. And I was like, what are you doing? He's like, and I explained to him, I said, you know, I'm a mountain biker. I've never done this kind of jumps. What do I do? He's like, actually, here's the biggest tip I can give you is go as fast as you can. And then what would happen is the bike is going to leave the ground, which is going to teach you the rhythm. So you might like lose the rhythm, but at least you'll know how it feels. And that worked. Like that was the thing that taught me how to do it. And then I became better at it. Like, do you have a similar thing on that place or you just like got it right away?
No. I think, you know, I think we all chase that flow state, which means you got to have rhythm because that's when your brain lights up, is when you get in that groove. And I guess for me, I felt like it came pretty quick, you know, being in my, like, what was it, 38, 40, right around that range. Mm-hmm. But I worked on it. I mean, it was like I felt awkward at first. I'm 6'4". I was riding a little bike with 20-inch wheels. Yeah. It felt weird.
Oh, whoa, you were riding a BMX bike?
I rode a BMX bike. I rented the 24-inch wheel, like,
I rode
cruiser.
26s always.
And then I did a 26-inch dirt jump bike, mm-hmm. too. So, yeah, I kind of tried them all out. And, you know, I ride a 29er now, so it was it felt small. I felt like Grape Ape on a mini bike. I mean, it just didn't quite fit. But nonetheless, you get, like, the fundamentals. And what's cool there is you could see other people doing it. So I was always afraid I was going to hit my head on one of the beams. So that was kind of weird because there's like kind of a lower ceiling there. But I never did hit my head. And it was such a cool place. It's a shame that it closed because it was really great. Because repetition is the key to all of this. And a lot of times when you ride, you hit a jump, you don't see it again until the next time you ride. But if you hit that thing 30 times. And so what that taught me is when I went to Black Rock, it said, okay, you need to hit this 30, do 30 reps. Same thing at Sandy Ridge. When I started jumping on those gaps, I remember I went out one Christmas. The ground was frozen. I put on all my gear, full face helmet and everything. And I just said, I'm going to hit this 30 times. And it's so funny. I look back at that and I'm like, I can't believe I wore all that gear. Because I would hit it now.
Just go for it.
If I forgot my helmet, I'd probably just hit it anyway.
Really?
I know. I hate to say that out loud. No. But yeah, I mean, it just feels so comfortable that it's hard to look back and think that I rode it with all that gear on.
I have another funny, like, really, like, it's funny for me story, but so I think we went there maybe 4 or 5 times, and on the, you know, I would hit the big line now, right? At this point, I was hitting the big line, which is not very big, but, you know, the big line there.
TNT. Yeah.
But, no, not TNT. I'm talking about, like, I'm talking about...
Oh, at the lumberyard.
The lumberyard. Oh, I mean, the jumps are, like, maybe 4 foot high, 4 foot across. They're not big, but again, there's a rhythm to everything, and they're tight together, right? They're grouped together, so you can't. There's no pedaling between jumps. There's no changing. Like if the rhythm is lost, you kind of lost all of it. Like you can't do it. And I was hitting it. Like I would jump and, you know, land perfectly on the other side, really high up. Like I felt like I'm doing it. And at some point I asked my wife, like, you got to take a video of this. I'm going to rock. I rocked this thing. I am amazing. And so my wife takes a video of it. And, you know, in the video you can hear my daughter. She was like 2 years old. Yay. You know, she's like cheering me on. And in my head, I'm totally like in the World Cup, just whipping it. And then I look at the video, and I think my front wheel is maybe a foot above the jump, but my rear wheel with my horrible technique is maybe an inch above it. I mean, I was clearing it, but seriously, 1 inch.
Photoshop can fix that, I guess.
Horrible. I mean, but I felt like the king of the world still. I mean, it felt good, right? It doesn't matter if you're an inch above it or a foot above it. You're, as long as you're clearing it, it counts, right?
Yeah.
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 So, but that taught me a lot. And then, so Eric, at the end of it, really helps me push it. He's a really fun rider to ride behind. He's really, he, like, every little rock on the trail he jumps off of, and he gets, like, 4 foot of air off of 2-inch rock, which is pretty amazing. He's slow as hell. I mean, he is slow as dirt moving, but I know I'm hurting you, but that's true.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Because okay. Everybody's slow compared to you, so it's okay. No,
well, you see, I'm in a shop that I'm not the fastest guy for sure. Plus, it's Ashland. It's full of a bunch of fast people. It sucks.
Yeah.
What is better to be? Slow guy or the fast guy? What's better?
Let's go back to 911s. It's better to drive a slow car fast than a fast car slow.
True. So,
there true. You go. I'm running with that.
So, okay, here's a question. Ready, Eric?
Hit me.
What was the thing or the event that made you feel like riding is your thing? And don't say, we're saying it every time, but don't say like, oh, when my parent let go and I felt the freedom. Like, there was a point where you said like, oh, biking is not just for me to ride around, but like, I freaking love it. And I want to do this thing.
So I say this, I've been addicted since I was probably 13, 14.
Mm-hmm.
I've built my whole life around riding a bike. I would never live anywhere that didn't have mountains to ride or trails to ride.
And yet you live in Eugene.
But they're still riding close by. And some stuff has been built.
True.
Thank
I've
you
seen
to the
that.
People that
I,
built it.
I, mm-hmm.
I won't name them by name because I don't know who's listening to this, but they did. Thank you. You made life better. But no, in all seriousness, I used to ride a freestyle bike and do practice little tricks hours and hours in the street and get mad and throw my bike and bend my axle pegs and all of that. But what really stuck with me is like the ethos in the magazines of the time. One called Freestyling. BMX Action wasn't quite as, didn't have quite the spirit of it, but it was kind of that anarchy, don't conform, don't let the corporate man
really
direct you. And that like was really formative to me because I think a lot of teenagers are trying to find their way, find an identity. And that just stuck with me and it still sticks with me. It's
where was it? Like this was in Virginia?
Portsmouth, Virginia.
That's fine. What was it like there? Like, did you have a BMX track, not track, BMX park next to your house? Or just, like, you would just go into a basketball court and practice?
In front of my house a lot of time on some kind of broken up pavement.
Mm-hmm.
Tennis courts were great.
Because it's good traction, right?
Lots of good traction. I'm sure tennis players didn't appreciate it. But, I mean, took care not to ding it up with my pegs. But here's the other little trick I learned. Like, the brakes on those bikes were cantilevers.
Right.
And our side poles, rather, and they just weren't the strongest. So what we would do is we'd take Coca-Cola and wipe it on the rims and then wipe it on the pads. And so you'd have, like, super great brakes until you rode through water, of course. But, yeah, I remember doing that, and that changed my life.
You know that when I started doing downhill, we met this guy from Romania that was giving us tips. And one of his tips was when your brakes squeal or don't brake well, Coca-Cola with sand. I wonder if it's a thing.
Coca-Cola fixes a lot of things, right? It takes
man,
the stains out of toilets
so bad.
And
yeah,
rust
blood.
Off a trailer hitch.
Yeah, and then people drink it, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny stuff. But I've been hooked on bikes for, yeah, ever since then. I mean, and like, you and I could talk about the Skelade. It never gets old.
No.
It is still, like, a brand new, like, every ride.
It is. Well, and it's kind of, what's interesting is the addiction. I mean, it's... We always say it's a healthy addiction, but it is an addiction. Like when I don't ride for 4 or 5 days, I mean, my mood is bad. Like I'm just like not coherent. I am an addict. And when I ride, I'm just like so much better. And truthfully, I mean, Eric knows this. How many years before I said I'm going to move to Ashland, I was telling you I'm going to move to Ashland as a dream. And the reason was biking. I mean, biking and to be fair, it's not just like the trails that we have here are the most amazing trails ever. That's not the case, really. It's just we have really good weather here. And we also have trails that regardless of the weather, are still good. So even if it rains here, the trail is better. Actually, it's better. So like, right, winter, spring, fall is actually better riding seasons than summer. But usually it doesn't rain here more than a couple hours at a time, which means rain stops. That means there's lots of traction. That means you can go ride. And then the other one is the trails are available from home. Like, I don't have to drive a foot. I don't have to start the car in order for me to go riding. And that was the dream, right? The dream was to move here for that. And I think you would remember how much you used to make fun of me. We would go and ride. We get to the top of Eagle's Rest, which is a trail in Oak Ridge. And you would just basically tell me, like, shut up. You're not moving. Like, stop doing it to yourself. And then one day I moved. And then, how was that? I left. Was that a thing?
It was a thing. Yeah. You used to come back a lot.
I did come back. Yeah, you're right. I did come back a lot to actually work on the car.
To work on the cars.
Yes, yeah. Yes. We work on our own cars. I don't know if it's a combination of being cheap or just being interested in that.
I think you're right. We're interested in it too. I mean, it's good to know your own.
We like stuff. It, but it's also, cheap.
You get some intimacy with the stuff, right? Sure. Just like when you do bike maintenance, you're like, okay, I put that chain on. So luckily chains don't snap like they used to back when, you know.
And you worked in a bike shop, right?
I did.
Yeah, when? Where was it? Like, also Virginia, also?
Colley
or
Avenue
Coast?
Bike Shop in Norfolk, Virginia. Yeah, I worked, really? I was a mechanic from, I don't know, 90, like maybe 89 to 90.
So at the time, what was your dream bike? Like, you would look in the magazine, what were you dreaming about?
Well, I was still riding freestyle bikes then, mm-hmm. like Haro Masters, and then a Bully was a brand that came out. Mm-hmm. Arl Osborne was a guy that used to ride for Redline and started his own brand, so I was riding that. Had a bash guard on it, so you could do like these long slides. But then I got into mountain biking. I got a Rockhopper first. Mm-hmm. With Hyperglide shifting just was coming out, mm-hmm. under the bar shifters, but we had to get rid of those and get the XT top mounts because those were still cool, and so then I got a Cannondale Beast of the East with a big pepperoni fork because that looked really cool. This was still rigid fork days.
Yes,
and I think it was 9-speed, and I'm still not convinced you need any more than 9 speeds, honestly, but here we are at 12, and my chain wears out every 2 months. But the dream bike, there was a Fuji Titanium with an IRD rigid fork. It was $1,900, and it was like the top of the line, and like the best you could get. And so that was the fantasy, is this Sandvik Titanium Fuji. Hardtail.
I wonder who made it for them, because Fuji did not make titanium.
No.
So I wonder if it was like a Lightspeed with a Fuji branded on it. Okay, I mean, Lightspeed was making bikes for the Tour de France also.
Yeah.
They were making bikes for everyone and just putting whatever you wanted, 7-Eleven, whatever you wanted.
Lightspeed was so sexy back then, the Giallo, the road bikes, and like just, they were great. They were, I mean, feathers.
Yes.
Like a rigid hardtail.
It felt like feather. Yes.
Yeah.
There is a time. Well, we actually, maybe 3 podcasts ago, we talked about how it's interesting. Like, I did the thing between like old cars and old bikes. Like, you don't lust riding old bikes the way you lust riding old cars. Old cars give you something that you cannot find in new cars, right? It's a certain feel that can never be duplicated, and therefore people have a lust for these old cars. But I never lust old bikes. Like, there's never a point where I was like, oh, I wish I had my downhill bike from 1996 or 2001. It's not a thing. It wasn't a feel that I want anymore.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, because cars are like the smell, they always smell like gasoline.
Fix your car.
It's like getting into a time machine.
Yeah.
And we all have the thing about nostalgia, right, is we all think it's like a simpler time, sometimes a better time. But we forget about the parts that really sucked, and so we scrub those out of our memory. But I don't know. I still have an OCLV Trek from 1998.
Mountain bike or road bike?
Mountain bike with XTR.
Yeah, but you wouldn't ride it.
No, I haven't, but I took it down Eagles of some, I don't know, it's been like 5 or 6 years now. I took it down Eagles just to see what it would be like.
And?
And I still had fun.
Sure, you ride a bike, but like fun, like would you do it again?
I would.
Like once a week kind of thing?
No, but I think a race series needs to come back with vintage mountain bikes.
Sure.
There's a vintage road thing.
Yes. Well, we said that. We actually, the same thing we said. I think it'd be really fun to have that because it is a good time. And I mean, you can buy bikes that used to be $5,000, which was equivalent to $12,000 bike today for like $1,000 right now, and have the top of the line bikes from 15 years ago and have a race like that. Maybe like you can't get anything newer than 2000 or 2001, right? Like no disc brakes,
right.
V-brake or less. You know, suspension duties, whatever it was back then. I'm not saying it's, but again, it's not like I don't go for a ride on my bike and think to myself, God damn, I wish I had my 96 Park Prix with Manitou Mach 5 fork. Like, there's never a point where I think to myself, that's what I want to ride when I go riding. It's fun. It's a good, it's funny almost. Like, you did this just to make yourself laugh, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't like, I want to go for a ride on that bike. It's just what it would be like to ride that bike.
29-inch wheels just roll better over stuff. And so that's better. And I think so it lights up your brain more because mm-hmm. you're going faster, right? Because none of us used to wear knee pads or any of that. But now it's like pretty commonplace because I think we were going slower.
I don't know. Do you think that's why? I just think that we're smarter now. And plus, knee pads are not as bulky as they used to be. Knee pads were like a evolution of motorcycle pads, and now they actually make bicycle pads.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're not heavy on you. They're easy to put on and off, right?
I feel naked without wearing them, even if... Yeah, sometimes I don't even pull them up, but I just feel like I have to have them on just in case.
On your lid. I don't wear pads ever. I think that's... You always, like, look at me like I'm weird, and you need that. That's your little bubble, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's fine. We all do it differently. But, So, okay, what we're going to do now, news. So I really like to add a couple of, like, news. So we talk a little bit just, and we just riff on this. So
yep.
Obviously he's not knowing what he's coming to. But so, all right, so here's one little thing. So Muckoff, clever new product allows you to hide an Apple AirTag in your wheels. Okay, ready for this, Eric?
Yep.
Why? Why the hell? Who wants this? I mean, can you explain to me why is that a thing?
People that want more surveillance. So when your boss can track you and see that you're riding
your
bike.
Hell, people. Woods. Like, how is that? Like, is that really a thing? Like, you want to track your bike? I mean, so is that good? Do you think this is for, to be fair, we don't write the article. We don't read the articles. So maybe there's a good reason in it.
To be fair.
I have not read it. I'm just looking at a picture of this dong, pink dong that you put the Apple thing AirTag in it. So is it for your bike getting stolen?
I think a city bike where it would theft is a problem.
No, but like, this is for tubeless. It's got to be tubeless. I kind of want to read the article, but I really don't care. I just find it to be very weird.
I guess if you're at the bike park, say in Whistler, and you park your bike and then you go inside and then it's gone, then you might be able to track it. But
I wonder, I wonder if there's actually usage for it where you connect it with Strava and get some other information you can get with just your regular phone or speedometer or GPS.
Kinds of fancy telemetry.
That's what I mean. Like, I wonder if there's a telemetry thing or anything like that. But anyway, that was a thing that I just could not understand. And I guess, yes, we set our piece on it. That's it. It's nothing I have to say. It's just awful. Please, if anyone has an idea why it's good, please let me know about it. And then next thing is we're going to this news thing about actually stuff that happened in Sea Otter. And this is just like me completely. Do you know, Eric, maybe you have some knowledge that I don't. How come helmets don't have enough padding to actually stop the freaking helmet from dripping all over your face?
You need more absorption of sweat. Is that what you need padding
Either
for?
That or something that drains the sweat backwards. Because you know how you get to the end of the climb and you press on the helmet and then just drips. All the sweat just pours all over you?
Yeah.
Please explain that. Do you have an explanation for that stupidity?
I don't think there's a problem like pushing on your helmet and letting it sweat, like letting it drip out. You could put your helmet on your bars and ride up without a helmet if you're on a fire road.
True, actually. I don't do that, though.
I don't either. It's too much to bang around on the handlebars. I think you just need to get some therapy and find a way to cope with it. It's not a big deal.
Really?
Yep.
Okay. Well, you know, that actually helped me a little bit. The other one, so you don't use Strava, right, Eric?
I do not.
Why?
I don't need to confirm that I'm slow.
But it's not that. It's just like you can just feel like you know what you're doing that way.
I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah, you do. Like you can see like how you did before and how you're doing now. Compare yourself on a, no?
I have
a,
the,
again, not interested.
I'll say that I'd rather suspect that I'm awesome than confirm that I'm mediocre. So I don't need Strava to tell me, like, man, you're truly mediocre. Because I feel like I'm awesome on the trail.
Because you go as fast as you can, so why the hell you need to ruin that?
Yeah.
Like, that experience. Yeah.
And most people I come across, I'm faster than them, up and down. So you telling me I'm slow doesn't really hurt my feelings, because I'm faster than most people I see on the trail. So take that.
I'm taking it. Okay. All right. So the next thing on the news is something I truly don't understand. Eric, do you use SPDs or flats?
SPDs.
I ride SPDs also. To be fair, I want to say this. We sell about 30 to 1 in the shop. 30 flats for every one SPD that I sell. I don't know why, but it's fine. It's not the issue. Here's the thing. I'm watching here. I'm looking at some, like, bunch of sets of SPDs from what it looks like. Egg beaters or whatnot. So SPDs have been around for how long, you think? Like 90s? 92, 93,
when
maybe?
I was a mechanic in a shop, they were just coming out. Yeah, so
yeah, that, so like early 90s, SPD yeah. came out, which is a Shimano way of clipping in, right? At the beginning, they had an issue because they used to gunk up any kind of anything, actually, used to make it not clip in. So especially muddy.
Yeah, that was more the pedal, I think, than the cleat.
Correct. It was the pedal. Not the cleat, the pedal. But then came Crank Brothers and Time, and they came up with a system that doesn't get stuck. But they were hard to get in and out of, and they didn't feel that great. And then, I don't know, what, 12 years ago, Shimano redesigned their pedal, and now the pedal is perfection. You agree?
Yeah, yeah, I think it's
solid. Perfection, right?
Yeah.
Patent ran out, like, I don't even know how long ago. Why the hell is not more people using that patent? Isn't it weird?
That's a good question. You're right. I think with the 30 to 1 ratio of flat pedals, maybe there's less of a market for it, and they just don't want to crank up the manufacturing line. But I think, you know, I've tried to ride flats, and I can do it. I actually went to riding flats so I could start doing no footers. Because I envisioned my 50-year-old self doing Superman airs and whatnot. That didn't happen, and it's the pedal's fault, I think. But
of course,
I kind of look around at, like, videos and stuff, and like other riders who I respect, and I see, like, what are they riding? And like one guy that really stands out to me that's still riding SPDs, I believe, is Remy Metayer. Mm-hmm. Lives up in Squamish, and you know, a super great rider, still mm-hmm. riding SPDs. And then,
yeah.
Then this guy, Gilad Goslin,
yeah.
he rides SPDs, super fast, you know, solid rider. So I don't think it really says, okay, if you're a rider that rides good or bad, it dictates what pedal you ride. I just think, like, whatever you're comfortable in.
No, but again, my question was, this is interesting. I didn't think of that. Maybe the market of SPD is dwindling. Like, less and less people are riding clip-ins. And so when other companies think to themselves, let's develop a pedal, even though it's, you know, using technology that already exists, they're like, there's no reason to get into it. Let's just get into flat pedals. There's a sure thing that we're going to sell pedal because there's just a need for that.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I didn't think of that. That's a really good... By the way, I don't know how other shops are doing. To be fair, I don't know if it's just us where we are, that more people are riding flats, or if it's like, it really is an industry thing where flats are just... The flats are the next big thing, basically.
Well, I'd say look at like 510, bought by Adidas, so things have changed. But
long
anyway,
time ago, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. But I think they have like one SPD shoe and like five variants.
Yeah,
of
but
the
when
flat
you look at
shoe.
But you look at any other company, they have the opposite, right? They have more. There's more companies making SPD shoes than there are companies making flat pedal shoes, and so 510 obviously has a grip on this. On this market, but maybe because the market is small, there's only you only need for like one company to make a good shoe.
You know, what's always funny to me.
What
is like the look of shoes? Like a CD has a certain look, right? It looks racy.
Yes.
And then when I see those on the trail, I'm like, what are you doing? Wear a regular shoe. That's why I like SPD shoes, like the 510s, because they look like regular shoes.
Yes.
But they have the clip on them, and like I always was. Never really understood that look with the CDs and the Shimano's.
Well, they're lighter.
They are lighter.
I ride Enduro Shimano shoe, which is lighter. It actually protects against, like, it's got a little neoprene in the back of the foot or the leg. So stone, like a little piece of stone and crap can get into your foot or while you pedal or riding down the hill super fast.
Are those new Birkenstocks you have there?
Yeah, you like it?
I do. I man, they wear out so fast, though. That was my issue with those, but I like them.
Well, not for little me.
You know, you have to treat that little cork in the back. That's some stuff you wipe onto it so it stays sealed up.
No way. Really?
Yep. It's in a little bottle. You can buy it. I have some. It didn't work because I wore the whole shoe out, and then I got it resoled with one of those Vibram
yeah.
soles, and then I wore that out, so it, like, wore out all the cork. Oh. But I don't know. I like them. I think the problem was they stretched out, and so they were like loose on my foot, and my wife and kids would just complain because they were like flopping around
when you're walking.
So they just bought me some flip flops.
We are talking about Birkenstocks, correct? And I'm wearing them. I love them. You will see me all summer with them.
They're super comfy. I probably need to get another pair. I guess they're not meant to last 4 years. But.
No, you know what the issue here at the bike shop is? You stand all the time on your feet. You're standing nonstop. And so having a good shoe is important. And I don't feel like walking with, you know, shoes.
Crocs are comfy. You still have some Crocs. And they came back.
You sweat in them.
What about those Yeezy Crocs?
No, leave me alone. I like my Birken. Listen, I'm nerdy and I know it. I don't have no problem wearing my Birkenstocks.
You have camouflage spandex. You could wear those with your...
I do. Actually, funny enough, this is my next question. My next thing on the news. But then I was like, it's not really news, but I have this question. So are you a bib fan or do you ride no bibs? I know the answer, but tell the audience.
Dude, I was a bib fan for a long time. And then I was like, what am I doing with this extra bit of laundry here? So I measured my sit bones. So I got a seat that fits properly. So I just ride my boxer briefs and
no bibs.
No bibs.
No chafing.
No chafing. Like, not painful.
What about
numbness.
Catching? You never catch on the seat anymore?
No, because the boxer briefs, like, keep everything tucked in there.
I can't believe that. That's crazy to me. Yeah. That's crazy talk right there.
Crazy talk indeed. But, it's weird, because I don't know anybody else that rides with just their underwear on.
I'm going to say that bibs are the thing to save me. I can only ride bibs. I can't imagine riding anything but bibs. I will have bibs under my, like, so even if I wear mountain bike shorts, I will have bibs underneath.
Here's another funny thing about you, Galad. You always wear, like, a jersey still.
And, yes, I still ride, like a mountain bike jersey.
Yeah.
Because the pockets.
Yeah, yeah. So I just wear a fanny pack and a t-shirt because I don't like to feel, like, that nylon on my skin. I think
really?
Cotton or some kind of, you know, cotton blend t-shirt is so much more comfortable.
By the way, Eric, it does look a lot cooler than me on a mountain bike. I'm weird. I know that.
It's okay. You're fast, so you can get away with it.
Whatever. You know what? I'm just used to it, I guess.
You know, I would come into the bike shop, and whatever you told me to, like, whatever tire to get, I'd be like, all right, he's fast. It works for him. I'll get that. And he steered me wrong a few times, but in general, pretty solid. Then I just stuck with Minions and the Acid guy now, and...
You know what I'm going to do? So sadly, we're not... This is our main subject topic for today is not that. But I have to do this with Nathan because Nathan is knows so much about tires, including having his own tire, right? He designed his own tire. There's a tire named Riddler out there. So every Riddler you people seen, including the Cross one, mountain bike ones, they're all Nathan design. And so he actually worked with WTB on designing a tire. So we're going to do a full episode about tire design. And kind of why they design a tire a certain way, what's the different measurements of it. It's going to be definitely a geeky thing. So this is part of the episode, I guess, will be like, why the hell there's no solution for a Minion? Because there's Minion and everything else. That's how I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's because where we live. Maybe it could be it's like the Northwest is a good Minion tire. But it's just you can't go wrong with a Minion, huh?
You cannot.
It's just,
you know, I hope in that episode you guys can also branch into talking about tires for Formula One because I think that's fascinating too, like the C1, C2, C3 tires.
Yeah, Formula we should One. Definitely do
so work that in there.
Yeah, 100%. We're going to work in the different soft tires versus mediums versus hard tires and the choice of when to put them in the race. Yes, 100%. Yeah.
Because I think it's also interesting, right? Like, I always thought if I ever had a podcast, what would I talk about? And I think so. There's some people out here, maybe 5 to 10 of them that are listening.
Two, yeah.
And they're probably into bikes.
Yes.
But like what I'm curious about is what else are you into?
Of course.
What other podcasts do you follow? And I think it's cool to kind of cross pollinate, if you will.
You know, it's not, maybe, how about this? Maybe you guys DM me and tell me what other topics you guys like, because maybe there's some coexistence between the topics. Maybe we can bring guests to talk about that stuff. Maybe we find out that all bike people also like, I don't know, something weird that we can talk about here, and I can bring people to do that. So how about that? DM me if there's an interesting topic that is not bikes that I can somehow add to, especially if it's cars, especially if it's a Porsche 996 Silver One. I know a lot about them.
Discolored carbon fiber in the interior.
Let's you talk have about that. Yeah. Yes. All right. So I do have a good topic for you. I think you're good because you're an outsider out of the bike industry for long enough,
mm-hmm.
where I think I am going to talk as the inside guy and you're going to be the outside guy.
Okay.
And then let's see what you think about it. So here is the topic. How to be a good customer for your bike shop, for your local bike shop. I think that's, I want to hear what you have to say. Like, how do you think yourself as a good customer? Is that important even to be a good customer? And then how do I see a good customer? I think that's two different things.
So I think it's important to visit your local bike shop for one. I mean, I think pre-COVID, everybody was shopping online because it was simply cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff that some of the online retailers were doing were just so far below the prices I think you guys could even get stuff for. So I think I drove a lot of people.
So wait. I want to 1 second. You guys, meaning we as a bike shop, used to order things online because it would be cheaper to order them online than to get it from our distributors.
Correct.
Listen to this again. You could buy it online, anyone could, for less money than I could even buy it for my bike shop. Which means that people would come to me like, hey, I can get something online for this and this price. Can you match it? And the answer is no, it cost me more money. And that was true. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, so I think it comes back into participating in your community. I mean, if you have a problem when you're trying to pop a bearing out in your linkage or, you know, change out something on your bike, and, you know, the online retailer's not going to be able to help you out.
No.
But your local bike shop is. So there's value in those guys that can solve your problems, give you recommendations, and they're just cool people just like you trying to earn a living. And I think, you know, much of our community and our society has been destroyed chasing this ever cheaper all the time kind of mentality. So local bike shops are great.
No, so okay, great. Thank you for the advertisement. But again, how are you as a customer? Like, what do you do anything different? Okay, let me ask you this question. Walking into a Costco and talking to the person there versus walking into a bike shop, do you act differently in a bike shop versus in a Costco or in any other retail store?
Maybe. I think, well, maybe I'm more interested in a purchase from a bike shop than I am.
Sure.
Elsewhere. But yeah, I want to know, like, the person I'm talking to, I want to know that they're a rider.
Mm-hmm.
Preferably.
So wait, how do you do that? What do you do? So, okay, first time in a bike shop, you know nothing about it. Like, so let's say you go on a trip to Moab, you walk into a bike shop. What's your kind of, what's the thing you're looking for as someone who rides?
I want to size up the person I'm talking to see if what kind of rider they are so I can qualify their recommendation. They say the trail's rowdy. I'm like, well, tell me, like, you know,
what do you ride?
Yeah. Where have you been and what does that look like?
So you walk into bike shops and you start with a full-blown interview.
Well, yeah, because let's face it, like a lot of dudes have egos, myself included, right? And you want to, like, whoever you're talking to, you're certain, you're like, I'm better than you or I'm faster or whatever. So you try to size everybody up and see where you are in the pecking order. But no, you want to know, like, when you get a trail recommendation, is it legit?
Yeah, sure. So, okay, so you do that. What else do you check in a bike shop? Or how else do you adapt yourself to, like, the idea that you're walking in the bike shop and when I get service, what do you do to be a better customer to them? Well, you don't care. Or you just think you're a good customer because you are a cyclist.
I don't care about being a good customer. I'm polite. I try to be polite to every human.
Okay.
And appreciate their time. I mean, a lot of mechanics, right? It's a skill.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes years to develop. But they're not compensated for that skill to a great degree. So I'm very appreciative and often will tip.
Mm-hmm.
If I get, you know, great service, especially if they have to drop something to, like, fix my issue. And yeah, that kind of sums it up. Just be a nice person. There's nothing.
So how about this? Do you ever wash your bike before you bring it in for a tune-up? Or not tune-up, anything?
I have a little bit of OCD, so I always try to keep my bike tidy. So yeah, I think it's the polite thing. It's the polite, exactly opposite of you.
What do you mean? Like my bikes are not clean always?
It's always a pig
immaculate.
Pen. Pig pen. Have you seen the inside of his 996? No. I think that's etiquette, right? It's like okay. You wouldn't go to the doctor right after you worked out in the gym. You take a shower. So same with your bike, right? Because that dirt falling off gets all over the shop floor and makes a mess, and maybe the shop doesn't have a facility to clean it. And...
So when you have a problem that is you can't fix, because so Eric obviously he's good technical skills and he knows how to work on bikes. But let's say you got to the point where you can't fix it, or by the way, you don't have the time, right? Having the time is a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you bring the bike shop when you usually go in there and have a problem? Like, what is your preparation as a customer? So, like, you bring it in and say, just fix it? Or do you actually come in and say, okay, do you try to find the problem and then tell the bike shop what it is? Or do you try to see what they do with the problem?
No, I usually get 3/4 of the way through it and say, hey, guys, I've stalled here. I can't get this last part. So that's just me personally. There's a different labor charge, like one if you just bring it in, another if you try to fix it yourself. And so, I try to clue them, like, here's where I am, and give them whatever detail. And then bring the parts in a bag,
mm-hmm.
labeled if you can.
Mm-hmm.
And
please don't do what he just told you. Just please don't mess your bike up. That's it. Sorry.
Please
go ahead.
Please don't mess your bike up. What is? I mean, it depends how comfortable you are with mechanical things.
True.
Some people
no,
aren't
if
very,
you're a mechanic, so. No, that's true. Yeah, he's very right.
So yeah, if I got into something like I bled the brakes and it's the lever's still not coming back and I'm bled it 3 times, I'm like, here's what's going on. I can't fix it. Can you? And they're like, yeah, what's the warranty? It's a defect. That's the issue. Or remember Zach? Zach pressed the bearings into my Yeti because
mm-hmm.
I spent hours trying to do it, then I forgot how to put the linkage back together. Despite looking at many videos online, I couldn't get it done. And then I chipped the paint and brought it to Zach at 6 o'clock on a Saturday night, and he spent a couple hours fixing it.
Oh my god, at 6 o'clock! So you stayed until 8 o'clock?
Yeah, Zach's awesome.
Zach is awesome.
Zach
from Life Cycle is my jam. That guy is really, like, he knows his stuff. I can't believe you made Zach stay late. He's got a kid.
But again, I think I compensated him for it too. Not that
it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's only fair.
Let me say a little bit about it. What I think of a good customer is, I really like customers that come in and actually do what you just described. Like, find out who we are and what we are, and like sizing up a bike shop is a really good thing to do. I think we all have the idea now, especially if we ride for a while. You know, when you walk into a bike shop, if it's the right bike shop for you or not. It's got to do with the bikes they carry. It's got to do with the accessories they have around. I think everyone likes to kind of walk around. When someone asks them if they need help, their first reaction, I think all of us, is like, no, we're good. We know what we're doing. And then, you know, as you kind of come into it, you actually start asking questions and find out more about them. You kind of kick tires, right? Before you actually, buy something. I think the biggest thing I want people to know is that, like Eric said this, we actually don't make a lot of money in bike industry. There's just no way around this. And treating the people nice is very important. Like, we really try hard. And one of our faults, I think, of every bike shop I ever owned, worked on, is that you try to make the person in front of you happy. And that's including taking away from your ability to actually help them. So, for instance, if you come to our shop, Tuesday, we close on Monday. You look at Tuesday of how much work we have on Tuesday. Usually it's triple the amount that we have any other day because we want to get things for the customer. Customer walk in and it's like, it's prime riding season, which in Ashland, to be fair, it's every day. Like, every season is prime riding season. And then you're like, you want to make it good for them. And then you find yourself staying here late. You find yourself not being able to do the work you need to do because you're just overcommitted for work. And so being understanding that every customer is as important, I think, to us as someone else. Like, if I do your work, that means I'm not doing someone else's work. So when bike shop says, hey, we're a couple of weeks out, be respectful for that. I know your problem is the most important thing for you because you're trying to, go ride your bike, and nobody wants to be not on their bike. But yeah, respectful to the mechanic, respectful for the bike shop. That's, again, that's the insight. That's for me to say of how I feel. And then I think the other thing is respectful for, like, our prices. I think people really try to beat us up and try to say, oh, we can get this online cheaper. I think that's, it's not a point. Like, I think if you find something online, just buy it. Like, you don't need to come to your local bike shop and say, hey, just do it cheaper because I found it cheaper online. It's like, okay, just bring it in, but just know that you might not get service. Oh, it's going to cost you money to get service for that piece. We can't always do cheaper. What you could have is that you're going to get it right away, and we will make sure that that piece works for what you need. So some people know what they need, and some people don't, and they just think they know what they need, and then they buy it online. And then we even get to the level that some people come to the bike, to a bike shop. Actually, it never happened here, but it happened to me in my old bike shop, where they would walk in because they bought the wrong part online cheaply, and then they would say, hey, would you take it and give me the right one? Because I don't know what to do with this. And the answer is, like, there's a reason why it was cheap online. Like, I can't forget there was a time where they were selling online these Thompson seat posts, but they were like 200 millimeter long. And it was like several weeks where people were coming in with these 200 millimeter long Thompson seat posts, try to dump it on us. You know, they bought them for like $40 instead of $120 for those seat posts. And everyone would come in. They found out it's too short. And it doesn't fit anything except for like an old school road bike. I think that, does it make sense, Eric? Like, everything I said here, or does it just sound like I'm whining?
Sounds like you're whining. But no, I think it's... It makes sense. I mean, you go into other places and you don't bargain. When you go into a big box store or mm-hmm. another retailer, you're not bargaining. And you don't even like those stores in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
Like Target, nobody's like feeling good or bad about Target. But a bike shop is like, that's your hobby. That's your sport. And probably guys you see on the trail. So it doesn't make sense to like beat them up on price.
You're also supporting your community. Like, you're directly affecting something in your community. When I'm not just saying the community of the people who live with you, but also the biking community. Like, having bike shops does affect how the community sees the effect of bikes onto the community. I can tell you in Ashland, right, having the bike shops affect the city decision. Like, we're more people that we can come in and say, hey, we have this, you know, there's this interest for the city to keep, to have more bikes, right, because of the businesses that are here. Anyway, I don't know. Just be nice. You know, don't be a schmuck when you walk into a bike shop. There's no reason for it. We all do it for fun. Like, and the truth is, for the consumer, I feel like because it's a hobby, it should be something where you walk in happy, you get service being happy, getting the service, and then leaving happy because you got the service you wanted or left with the bike you wanted. Like, all of this should be fun. And I think the last thing, and I say this to people all the time, people come here and they try to like compare bikes. Like, someone will come to a bike shop and say, oh, you have, I don't know, Kona, and I saw a Trek. What's better? Nothing is better. Like, the money spreads the same way. Always buy the shop, don't buy the bike. Like, do you agree with that?
Like, yeah. Yeah. I think at a certain, at every price point, bikes are roughly all the same.
They are. Like, a $800 bike from me and an $800 bike from Trek. I mean, Trek might put a better derailleur, but that means they reduce something on the wheels or on the seat or on the bar. But the money spreads the same way. You don't get extra for no one. You know, including online retailers. Like, people think like, oh, look at these components I'm getting. Well, they're cutting somewhere. Nothing is cheaper in this world. A dollar doesn't go further than $1, right? And people come here and try to do these, like, comparison between my bike or what we carry versus someone else carry. And my response to it is always like, buy the shop, because not like anything else you ever buy, the bike shop is the only place you buy something and then come back to the same people to get it fixed. And you also have a repertoire with those people. Like, you will come back a lot. Like, a bike is not something that doesn't need work. And actually, opposite of other things, the more expensive the bike is, usually the more work it needs, which is kind of the opposite of what you get from a refrigerator, let's say, right? The more expensive refrigerator you buy, the less chance you're going to have probably fixing it. I'm mumbling now too much. He's giving me a face. I'm trying to figure it out.
Well, I like the English as your second language, and you're going to build a repertoire with people instead of a rapport.
Oh, rapport.
I think we've beat this horse enough.
Okay, done. All right, it's fine.
Yeah, what's next on your spreadsheet?
No, that's it. That's I think we had a day. Yeah, 54 minutes. That's we're good.
That's solid.
That's solid.
I look forward to talking about other topics you guys are interested in, be it economics, car tires, what's your favorite needlepoint, yarn, knitting, whatever it is. I mean, I think as long as you're passionate about something, I think it's cool to hear because, you know, all of us we're diverse people, and it's more than just bikes.
True.
And people that ride bikes are usually pretty cool, so I bet they're probably into other cool stuff too.
You're actually right about that. I have to say this, everyone. Please sign up for the Cascadia race. Come to our bike shop. It's awesome. What else? Oh, it's really important that if you're listening to it, however many of you are listening to this, please, there's like 5 stars thingy. If you like us, give us the stars. If you want to write something, do that. It really helps other people find the podcast. So that would be really great. I'm going to be in Vegas, so that's why we're recording at 9 p.m. or 10 p.m. almost on what day is today?
Saturday.
Eric was nice enough to help me. So thank you, everyone, and we'll see you next Thursday. I don't even remember. I don't even know what we're going to do next Thursday, but it's going to be awesome. Thank you.
All right. Bye. Good night.